Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hard to Be Human, Overcoming Our 5 Cognitive Design Flaws, by Ted Cadsby, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Introduction. Other animals have it easier. You and I are freaks of nature. The only surviving species in the most complex genus of the primate order in the mammalian class of animals. We Homo sapiens are a 7-million-year-old hominin experiment that actually began 4 billion years ago when the first living cells embarked on a trial-and-error path that dead-ended for our Neanderthal cousins and many other human species. We bumbled our way through various obstacle courses that the other humans failed to navigate, and here we are. Rudimentary animals with an added layer of mental capacity, off-the-rack primates with souped-up brains. Although, in fairness, souped-up doesn't do our gray matter justice. An elephant's brain is 3 times as large and has 3 times as many neurons, 257 billion versus our 86 billion. But most of its neurons are crammed into its cerebellum, which navigates its huge body and hard-working trunk, leaving a small portion of neurons for its cerebral cortex, the seed of high-level thinking. We, on the other hand, have 3 times as many cerebral neurons, some of which make up our unusually large prefrontal cortex, the seed of super-high-level thinking. No other animal has anywhere close to our cerebral neuronal density, which is the basis of our remarkable cognitive complexity, including the unique form of human consciousness. As impressive as it is, this cerebral complexity also underlies the human predicament. Tortured by our own minds like no other animal, we expend a lot of mental energy reliving past anguish, anticipating future distress, stewing in self-righteous anger, and reacting to triggers that are products of our overreactive imaginations. If other animals could study us the way we study them, they would be puzzled by our unique ability to inflict misery on ourselves. They would call us out for what we are, oddly paradoxical creatures who long to be happy while creating our own suffering in the form of anxiety, fury, depression, self-pity, and even self-loathing. We worry about things we have no control over. We aspire to goals we lack the discipline to achieve. We whine about not being understood while casting a critical eye on others. We stubbornly defend our entrenched opinions despite ambiguous, if not contradictory, evidence. Complicating all of this is our struggle to adapt to a complex world that we ourselves created. The paradoxes of being human are stacked high. While they don't know it, other animals have it easier. Comparing humans and other animals, the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer had an interesting perspective on who suffers more. In his 1851 essay, On the Suffering of the World, he argues that there is no contest. Boredom is a form of suffering unknown to brutes, whereas in the case of man, it has become a downright scourge. Human needs are much more difficult to satisfy than those of the brute, because the brute is much more content with mere existence than man. Brutes show real wisdom when compared with us. Their quiet, placid enjoyment of the present moment puts us to shame for the many times we allow our thoughts to make us restless and discontented. Evil presses upon the brute only with its own intrinsic weight, whereas with us, the fear of its coming often makes its burden 10 times more grievous. Schopenhauer points out that only humans are haunted by the specter of their own death. Ultimately, need and boredom are the 2 poles of human life, and suffering in human life is out of all proportion to its pleasures. He concludes that we should actually envy other animals, because the human life is characterized by misery, where each of us pays the penalty of existence in his own peculiar way, but misfortune in general is the rule. He suggests that we humans should address one another as my fellow sufferer. Lest you are tempted to dismiss Schopenhauer as comically extreme, he reminds us that most ancient Indian and Greek mythologies put human misery at the center of their stories, as does the Christian doctrine that We come into the world with the burden of sin upon us, having to continually atone for this sin. I would add that the seeming serenity of Buddhism starts from the premise that life is interminable suffering, and that suicide appears to be a unique human affliction. While other animals can inflict harm on themselves and respond to trauma with self-neglect, they do not demonstrate an intent to kill themselves. As science writer Jesse Baring puts it in his book Suicidal, "On no occasion has a distraught or ostracized ape ever been seen to climb to the highest branch it could find and jump. That's us. We're the ape that jumps." In fact, research indicates that at least 40% of us contemplate suicide at some point in our lives, and fully half of that group formulate plans to carry it out. It would appear that it takes the complexity of a human brain to have the sophistication to curtail its own existence. It's hard to sum up the human condition, but physician Russ Harris does a pretty good job. The psychological processes of a normal human mind are often destructive and create psychological suffering for us all, sooner or later. What's our problem? I like the way author Nassim Nicholas Taleb captures our predicament. Our minds are like inmates, captive to our biology, unless we manage a cunning escape. Remember these last six words, because I'll come back to them. In fact, our minds have minds of their own. Of the many human paradoxes, this is the central one and the primary source of our unique struggle. We are captive to ourselves. Our well-being depends on a 3-pound electrical meat machine with a long, circuitous history of development that yielded some amazing features, but also some troublesome glitches. Not bugs, per se, since the flaws are embedded in the features themselves. The problem, at a high level, our brains are imperfect in substantive ways that are not obvious to us. The massively complex information processing apparatus that is the human brain is a jerry-rigged contraption that evolution built over an extended period by gradually adding new components to an original operating platform. This unimaginably long development process, which is still in progress, has culminated in a peculiar and somewhat sloppy fusion of an ancient, basic thinking system that operates subconsciously and a modern, special one that is largely conscious. Cognitive scientists typically refer to the older and newer systems as System 1 and System 2, respectively. Each system can be crudely associated with distinct brain areas, but there is significant anatomical overlap between them. And there are a couple of significant kinks in the overall design of this cognitive machinery, features that entail flaws in need of a fix. First, System 1 does most of the work, but its features were designed to facilitate survival in a different kind of world than the one we live in now. System 1 design flaws cause us to misperceive reality in significant ways. The Buddha insisted that human suffering is the result of an illusory view of reality, and that the elimination of suffering depends on a deep, meditative acknowledgement of the facts of existence. We can quibble about what these facts are, but his general insight is piercing. Human suffering is largely a function of misunderstanding how the world, including other people, actually works. Second, because System 1 functions largely below the level of our consciousness, its design flaws are concealed from our day-to-day awareness, even though they produce conspicuous distress for us. Decades before Sigmund Freud wrote about the unconscious, our friend Schopenhauer posited that the largest part of our thinking and motivation is hidden from us. System 1's errors wouldn't be so problematic if we were able to account for them more easily and use System 2's more analytic approach to override them. But the marriage between System 1 and System 2 is not an equitable one. Old and new don't always work well together. Our ancient cognitive system, which governs the vast majority of our thinking, feeling, and behavior, yields little authority to the newer cognitive system, which has the capacity to be better behaved and better adapted to our modern world. Good historical reasons support System 1's dominance. Its speed was crucial for survival in the past, and still is. But the imbalance between the two thinking systems is outdated. System 2's backseat role is ill-suited to being human today. So it's hard to be human, because our extraordinarily complex brains are hard to manage. Much of our incremental suffering, above and beyond what other species endure, arises from 1. System 1 design features that often morph into design flaws, clouding our ability to perceive reality accurately, and 2. System 2's inability to detect and correct the flaws, constrained as it is by System 1's overbearing nature. What are the specific design features that become flaws and cause us misery? 5 big ones stand out. Are there fixes? Yes, there are fixes. Maybe more accurately described as workarounds, but fixes nonetheless. Features become flaws. The Big 5. System 1's shortcomings induce us to underthink and overreact. We think too little and emote too much. We mindlessly take mental shortcuts for problems that require greater cognitive sophistication, and we are taken hostage by emotions whose intensity is disproportionate to their triggers. Underthinking and overreacting are, I believe, the two big precursors to human suffering. But also contributing to our struggle are their opposites, overthinking and underreacting. We overthink when we obsessively ruminate about trivial things or situations over which we have no control, and we underreact when we neglect the pleasure and serenity available to us in the present moment. The first step in making it easier to be human is to identify our 5 big cognitive flaws emanating from 5 big design features. 1. Greedy reductionism. We simplify everything we think about, design feature, including the more complicated scenarios in our lives that other animals do not have to contend with. Flaw, chapters 3 and 4. Our greedy desire to reduce reality means we oversimplify. 2. Certainty addiction. We are addicted to the feeling of certainty, design feature, despite being confronted by ambiguity and uncertainty that do not plague other animals. Flaw, chapters 5 and 6. We are overconfident. 3. Emotional hostage-taking. We react swiftly and strongly to threats, design feature, but are prone to overreacting, in part because of the unique human proclivity for excessive, unproductive rumination. Flaw, chapters 7 and 8. We take ourselves emotionally hostage. 4. Competing selves. We adapt with flexibility to different people and different situations, design feature, but, unlike other animals, we are afflicted with fractured psyches, the competing drives within us that often clash. Flaw, chapters 9 and 10. We are burdened by inner conflict. 5. Misguided search for meaning. We are constantly trying to make sense of things, design feature, but struggle to find overarching meaning in our lives and impending deaths, a conundrum that other animals are not perturbed by. Flaw, chapters 11 and 12. We are misguided by asking the wrong question about life's meaning. Our 5 flaws have become even more problematic in the past century because the modern world is not as friendly to System 1's intuitions as the world lived in for thousands of years by our farming ancestors, and the world lived in for hundreds of thousands of years before that by our hunter-gatherer ancestors. In the Savannah Desert, and even more recently on the farm, our ancestors could rely on straightforward cues to interpret threats and opportunities. Their mental shortcuts and emotional triggers were well matched to the challenges they faced, just as they are for other animals today. But the same cognitive mechanisms are ill-suited to today's complexity, whose important cues are buried and ambiguous. We are socially interconnected in ways that are barely comparable to the small farming communities that 90% of us inhabited just a handful of generations ago. Our forebears could not have fathomed the nuances of navigating a fulfilling career path, nor the difficulty of raising kids in a world dominated by social media, nor the existential risk of nuclear war and climate change. They certainly could never have imagined that we'd be walking around with supercomputers in our pockets, aka phones, bombarding us with an avalanche of information, and the overwhelming challenge of separating good information from bad in the age of big data. All this change occurred in an evolutionary instant, and our brains haven't kept pace. It's not that we're always blowing it. We get a lot of things right, or close enough. But, as writer H.G. Wells noted in the 1940s, hard imaginative thinking has not increased so as to keep pace with the expansion and complications of human societies. More recently, Taleb has pointed out that human knowledge, because it was developed in a past world that is very different from today's, does not transfer properly to the complex domain. So I would add to Schopenhauer's extensive list of comparisons, other animals have it easier because their instincts are well matched to their world, an environment similar to the one in which their brains evolved. We no longer live in our environment of evolutionary adaptedness, so our evolved cognitive shortcuts are often mismatched to our new reality. Features become flaws. Design feature to modern world complexity to design flaw. It's hard to be human, because human thinking and feeling are often poorly matched to the reality of human life, owing to mental design features that can become flaws, which are accentuated in our modern world. The human predicament, thankfully, is not hopeless. We just need the cunning escape that Taleb alludes to, a way to free ourselves from an ancient brain system that dominates our thinking and feeling. The escape takes some clever maneuvering, because our cerebral deficiencies hide below our day-to-day awareness. They are less obvious than the physical design flaws of our evolved bodies, such as our sore backs, weak knees, vulnerable ankles, and decay-prone teeth. But just as we learn to keep our backs straight when we pick up heavy loads and brush and floss our soft teeth, so too can we learn to overcome our cognitive design flaws. Unlike other animals that are captive to their biology, we are hostage only to the extent that we mindlessly default to our instincts, intuitions, and automatic responses. What's our solution? The complexity of human consciousness gives us a degree of freedom to be less miserable and better adapted to the 21st century, not to mention to be nicer people, to overcome our misguided, misbehaving, and masochistic selves. But this freedom doesn't come easily, since, in the spirit of the Buddha, it requires that we first see reality, including other people and even ourselves, more clearly. The insights of psychology, neuroscience, physics, and philosophy, collectively, provide a variety of powerful strategies to combat the mental design flaws that make life difficult. These battle plans are the purview of System 2, because they are not intuitive or natural for System 1. In fact, they are anathema to System 1's design, as I will explain in the next chapter. But it's impossible to fully engage System 2 without a concerted effort to climb out of the vortex of System 1-produced thoughts and emotions. We need a place to escape our relentless automatic thinking, a place we can climb into to get a clearer view, a place I refer to as the space between, for reasons I will explain in Chapter 2. The deeply complex human brain is both the source of unique human suffering and the remedy for the incremental pain we inflict on ourselves. Feature to flaw. Problem. Two cognitive systems, including one that dominates when it shouldn't. Fix. Solution. The subservient system has a secret weapon to correct the power imbalance. The first step and focus of Chapter 1 is understanding the human predicament as the wobbly marriage between our two thinking systems. The second step, and focus of Chapter 2, is exploring the extraordinary solution to this big problem, opening and expanding the space between, where, by escaping System 1's stronghold, we can empower System 2's ability to implement corrective strategies for each design flaw. The balance of this book examines the five design flaws and practical methods of getting around them. So I invite you, fellow sufferer, as Schopenhauer would have it, to join me in exploring why life is harder than it needs to be. Along the way, I'll share some personal struggles as a means of illustrating the ideas, and I encourage you to reflect on your own dilemmas. We all have histories that can be mined for insights on the challenge of living the human life. I don't pretend to have answers for all that ails us, but I have corralled some of the best ideas of acclaimed thinkers to circumvent the constraints of our default intuitions and their blunt, unproductive responses to the personal and collective challenges we face. The cunning escape from ourselves is available for the taking within each of us, and the payoff is enormous. This is the final and ultimate paradox of Homo sapiens. Escaping ourselves makes it easier to be human. It's hard to be human because we inflict misery on ourselves, because our brains are distinctively complex, such that our cognitive design features are vulnerable to becoming flaws, especially in an increasingly complex world, where our thinking and feeling are poorly attuned to the reality of human life. But there are powerful workarounds for the unruly party in our heads. Part 1. The Human Predicament. Chapter 1. Big Cognitive Problem. Man is the most botched of all the animals, and the sickliest. Friedrich Nietzsche. The list of our body's design imperfections is a long one, and the brain is no exception. In order to move, a body needs a brain. Unlike immobile life forms such as plants and floaters like jellyfish, the brains of traveling animals evolved to navigate their environments. While the human brain may be the most sophisticated algorithmic compressor or Bayesian processor on the planet, it still expends most of its energy performing an elaborate version of what all animal brains do, getting us through another day and coaxing us to duplicate ourselves along the way. Given enough time and mutations, Mother Nature's trial and error process, aka natural selection, is a competent but highly imperfect engineer. Like all living things, we are a patchwork of bits and pieces that were shaped, reshaped, and added to over time. For example, our throats open in two passages, one leading to the lungs and another to the stomach, which makes us vulnerable to choking when food goes down the wrong tube. The list of our body's imperfections is a long one, and the brain is no exception. The human brain was cobbled together over millions of years of sculpting and rework, with natural selection gradually adding new mechanisms to old ones. The result is, figuratively speaking, two brains: the old one, which operates largely below our conscious awareness, and the new one, which evolved more fully over the past 100,000 years and is the key to conscious self-awareness. Our unique two-in-one brain is what creates trouble for us, though, because the two don't always play well together. Their interaction is the focus of this chapter, and our two-in-one design is the first of five crucial things to know about the intricate human mind. Need to know number one. We have two brains in one. The old brain is our ancient automatic thinking system, the kind most animals are limited to, and the basis of our subconscious intuition. The new brain is our modern, effortful thinking system, the basis of voluntary, conscious deliberation. Some other animals are capable of this second type of thinking, but in a much simpler form, such as chimps experimenting with tools. But our kind of effortful thinking is brand new. Its prototype originated in great apes sometime in the past 15 million years, leading to the first human primates and eventually fully conscious, self-aware, modern humans sometime in the past 30,000 years. The distinction between automatic and effortful thinking, referred to as the dual process model of human cognition, is obvious in many examples: eating a meal versus cooking one, walking across a street versus planning a vacation. We're usually not attentive to our mental processes when eating and walking. The thinking is largely subconscious, whereas cooking and planning require some concentrated effort. While psychologists generally agree on the points of contrast between the two thinking processes, the terms they use to describe each are nowhere near universal, as this very partial list reveals. Automatic, ancient. Intuitive, instinctual. Emotional, reflexive, system one. Effortful, modern. Analytic, controlled, rational, reflective, system two. Systems 1 and 2 are the most commonly used descriptors, and the terms I will be using. The fusion of old System 1 and new System 2, while one of Mother Nature's more miraculous achievements, is still a work in progress. System 1, fast thinking, and System 2, slow thinking, haven't quite got their act together, largely because the former, the ancient brain system, is a bully. Need to know number two. System 1 is a bully. We are largely at the mercy of our System 1 ancient brain, because it orchestrates the vast majority of our thinking and behavior, and because its workings are largely opaque to our conscious awareness. Whereas System 1 chugs along as consistently as our heart beats, System 2 works at its highest potential only sporadically. Despite the impressive accomplishments of System 2, as in Shakespearean plays and Einsteinian physics, it is slow and inconsistent, easily distracted and readily influenced by external factors such as how much sugar is in our bloodstream and how much sleep we've had. It may not seem like it, but we are very selective in how we focus System 2's effortful attention. We're quite stingy with how much intense concentration we're willing to commit to any particular problem. How do we decide when to engage our precious effortful thinking? Here's the kicker. The amount of effortful System 2 we invoke is largely determined by automatic System 1, based on its own assessment of whether the effort is worthwhile. As psychologist Daniel Kahneman notes, when System 1 runs into difficulty, it calls on System 2 to support more detailed and specific processing. System 2 is mobilized when a question arises for which System 1 does not offer an answer. This principle is key to understanding how the human mind works. Effortful thinking is largely at the mercy of the automatic thinking that underlies it. There is no conscious System 2 without subconscious System 1 preceding it. First of all, subconscious thinking is always at the party. In fact, it's basically System 1's party. Subconscious System 1 kicks in at between 350 milliseconds and a full 10 seconds before conscious awareness of an event. It's why we jump at the sound of a loud bang before we consciously process that it's just a car engine misfiring. The speed of System 1 is what protects us and why we're still here. It's also why we fly off the handle in rage before we catch ourselves and wish we hadn't lashed out. Second, as the party's de facto host, System 1 decides whether to invite System 2 or not, as per Kahneman's observation. It's worth repeating. System 1 processing brings into conscious awareness whatever it deems worthy of further deliberation. That is, when it decides it needs System 2's flexible and deliberative strength to help figure things out. If System 1 feels it has everything under control, as in eating and walking, then it won't bother inviting System 2 to the party and wasting precious mental energy. Third, not only is System 2 late to the party and only there at the invitation of System 1, but System 2, upon arriving, often has great difficulty finding the host. The subconscious thoughts and motivations that give rise to our conscious thinking are often hidden from our awareness and therefore difficult to access and challenge. System 1 is so powerful, we are so captive to our subconscious automatic thinking, that psychologists have created a variety of metaphors to describe its dominance. David Eagleman: our consciousness is like a stowaway on a steamship, taking credit for the journey without acknowledging the massive engineering that is actually running the ship. Jonathan Haidt: automatic thinking is the powerful elephant on whose back conscious deliberation rides as an advisor, attempting to cajole the elephant. Steven Pinker: the conscious mind is a spin doctor whose job is to create a story that explains the actions the unconscious mind initiates. Owen Flanagan: consciousness is a figurehead president. It has status and putative authority, but it is limited to explaining the real work and output of the subconscious. Daniel Wegner: we may feel that we are freely choosing, but subconscious processing is doing the choosing for us and just letting us know what it has decided. Daniel Kahneman: System 2 is a supporting character who believes itself to be the hero, but System 1 is more influential as the secret author of many of the choices and judgments you make. Although some psychologists argue that conscious thinking is nothing but the pawn of the powerful cognitive operations that reside below our awareness, the majority are convinced that conscious, effortful thinking can have some influence over the subconscious operations that underlie it. Otherwise, contrary to our everyday experience, any notion of free will would be nonsensical, and we would have no ability to change our habits or redirect our goals. But this power over ourselves doesn't come easily because of the bullying. System 1 pushes us to overeat when System 2 tells us not to. to lash out at people when System 2 knows we are escalating conflict, to stay up late watching TV when System 2 knows we need more sleep, and System 1 bulldozed.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?